Okay, so that's You Sound System, Gary Clail, from, now, which year was that? 1991, Human Nature. Seems like another world, doesn't it? Bristol music going out to the world with a fantastic, very positive and powerful message. Anyway, welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The mark of the beast, and it's British. Who said UK manufacturing was dead? The COVID pass. Who's funding it? And is this Blair and Brown's ID card's second wave? Remember, we campaigned against this with No to ID starting in 2004. Thought it was finally killed off in 2010, the national ID card scheme. The COVID pass is what one venture capitalist, Sir Ronald Cohen, thinks we all need. He says the cost to governments of his COVID pass to let us back into pubs will be tiny compared to the $350 billion being lost every month in lack of manufacturing in the US alone. Plus vaccines, the great TV debate we haven't yet seen between Bill Gates and an actual doctor, British anti-vaccine physician Dr. Andrew Wakefield. We don't have that, I'm afraid. It'd be really lovely to see it, but we don't have that here. I don't know if it's ever going to happen. It'd be lovely to see it. It's the obvious thing for a producer or a journalist to do. But we do have something called The Truth About Vaccines from the US group. Second best, I'm afraid. And a cameo appearance from Dr. Wakefield on health risks of the COVID-19 vaccine from his new home in California, asking if we've learned anything at all from the Nazi experiments on humans. That's Andrew Wakefield asking that. And also, in the wider picture, Meng Wanzhou. Remember her? China's Huawei's chief financial officer. She's currently under house arrest in Vancouver, Canada. But she was arrested 18 months ago in December 2018 under American orders. Every time the US moves closer to extraditing her, China moves against Hong Kong and America's allies in the region, it seems. And also related, perhaps, to a troop movements in Asia, in India and China. What's going on there? And also China's mission to Mars and America's attempt to privatize space. So, Martin, let's start, I think, by going to one of the last things I was talking about there, which is Meng Wanzhou. A lot of people have forgotten about this arrest of Huawei's chief financial officer, but it is actually, many people would argue, and I certainly would argue, that this is what has really sparked some of the real political tensions in China, particularly those in Hong Kong, because the government has been attempting, the Chinese Communist Party, to do similar sorts of extraditions from Hong Kong into mainland China, as America is attempting to do, in this case, from Canada into the US.
Well, the tensions are obviously palpable on every level. And obviously she was arrested some time ago.
18 months ago, yeah.
But before all of the tensions that have blown up around the pandemic. And it may be the case, as you say, that the Chinese wanting to extradite people from Hong Kong was related to her arrest. But of course, the central government in China have backed down on extradition from Hong Kong. But protests have continued because there's no real trust on the ground in Hong Kong for the central government. They for their part are taking a rather hard line because they feel as if they're being pushed into a corner by Trump, and that they can't afford to be too liberal about it all. Not to put too fine a point on it. So the dangers are palpable in Hong Kong itself. If they've got any sense, the Chinese central government will not intervene too much. What's actually beginning to happen, of course, is the economy in Hong Kong is going down the drain. And I don't think that if they are wise, the central government will just let that happen. They say, you don't want to be part of China, fine, we're not going to bail you out. And you can't, you can just stew in your own juice. And then if ultimately some kind of compromise might be achieved, it's going to be very difficult because it's quite possible just by accident that some kind of shooting war is going to start, in which case the Chinese People's Liberation Army will take over Hong Kong in an afternoon.
A US destroyer has been sailing around near China-claimed islands. adding to mounting tensions. The US relations with China, this is Jason Ditz on antiwar.com, are being called the worst in 40 years, an ever-growing litany of reasons why, from the US blaming China for coronavirus to US hostility towards Chinese telecom company Huawei. One of the most dangerous devices on territorial claims, where the US has been challenging Chinese maritime claims in the South China Sea, usually doing so with deliberate naval confrontation, sending warships close. Maritime challenges resulted in harsh rhetoric in the past, but this week the USS Martin, a guided missile destroyer, sailed right next to two Chinese claimed Paracel Islands, Woody Island and Pyramid Rock. No direct confrontation, but Martin, this sort of thing doesn't necessarily help the situation.
No, it doesn't. And if you put the shoe on the other foot, what would the Royal Navy do if the Chinese Navy insisted on steaming up and down the channel? They can, because it's an open water, but they would definitely be following them around and saying, what are you doing here?
But yeah, maybe around the Solent, you know, next to Portsmouth or something.
Well, indeed, like. Indeed. And of course, these artificial islands or whatever they are, the Spratlys, the Chinese, from their point of view, they're pursuing a defensive strategy, which is there are lots and lots of imports and exports that China makes, including lots of oil, comes through the South China Sea to the major cities on the coast of China. Now, from their point of view, making sure that anybody can come into that area is quite important. But they don't want other people's warships in that area, unless by agreement. I mean, you remember the fuss there was when the Russian aircraft carrier went through the channel. I mean, it's the only place it has to go through somewhere if it's going to go anywhere. But of course, it caused all sorts of ructions. And both in Russia and on the coast of China, NATO and the British, and don't forget a British frigate was involved in this task force sent to arrest Maduro, supposedly for drug dealing. And of course, one good thing this week is it looks like the Iranian tankers which were taking oil to Venezuela have mostly gone through the US blockade without being stopped. Probably because if they were stopped and there was a problem, then everything would have escalated straight away over the top. Now, underlying all of this, of course, is the pandemic. And it kind of, and as I've mentioned on before, and of course, the YouTube of our show, which I mentioned, this was the one that YouTube took down. The Israeli Defense Forces had a warning from NATO about a pandemic coming from China in November. And that is courtesy of the Times of Israel. That's a pretty interesting straw in the wind. And coming back to what Steve Williams was saying earlier about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, rather disappointed by that. Most of the people who are being victimised here are consistent anti-racists, and they're being basically picked on, like David Miller, because they won't toe the line on Israel's annexations and aggressions.
I mean, they bomb Syria consistently. It does rather suggest that there may be a war in the pipeline, and that we are supposed to be unswervingly on Israel's side in that war.
Well, indeed, and all of these things are coming to a head. As you know, if what may have happened, I mean, we've discussed this in the past. There are a number of possibilities. This either was a naturally derived virus, or it's escaped somehow from either the Wuhan laboratory or another laboratory, possibly Fort Detrick in the US, which was closed down last June. Or it's a deliberate biological warfare attack, which the Chinese have thwarted by pursuing the anti-biological warfare techniques which they've been training for. But of course, if they knew it was an attack on them, they are not necessarily going to tell the Americans that they know. They're just going to make their preparations to get their not to get mad, but to get even. That's how dangerous this all is.
Okay, some more stories on China. US could conduct nuclear tests in months, one of the Pentagon officials says. Well, there's supposed to be a nuclear test ban treaty, but apparently the Americans think it's necessary.
Well, they've also said that the Russians and the Chinese have carried out secret tests, although they've not presented any evidence about that. They're withdrawing from all the nuclear treaties that they've signed with the Russians. But that's because they want to surround China with short-range missiles. The Chinese basically, I mean, what would the Americans do if the Chinese surrounded the Americans with short-range missiles? And they say, well, there's nothing, there's just a deterrent, you know. And of course, they don't perceive it like that. And the danger here is miscalculation, just as in the run-up to World War One. Everybody followed the playbook that they were following, and it eventually led to a conflagration.
I mean, this whole idea...
They've just talked themselves into it.
This whole idea of having a nuclear test, well, one would have thought that that's not going to necessarily be necessary in order to see if their nuclear weapons work. I think they do work. But, of course, it sends a very clear message, doesn't it? Look what we can do to you, China.
Yes. And, of course, the others... I think both the Russians and the Chinese... Oh. The Chinese have only got about 300 nuclear warheads. The Russians and the Americans have got thousands and thousands between them. So the Chinese quite rightly say, you can't involve us in discussions about reducing nuclear weapons. We've got the bare minimum. And it's quite, you know, they're developing missile technology and submarine technology to deliver their warheads. But they're not trying to get loads more. There's no point. I mean,
Surely the US military thinking is very much like it was in the 1960s with Russia, is we're so far ahead of China with nuclear weapons that if we attack them now, we can win.
Well, they do talk about that in that sort of way, madly enough. But the Chinese have always taken the view, and I think quite rightly, if you nuke us, we will nuke you back. And that's all you need to be able to do. But of course, NATO doctrine, US doctrine, British doctrine has always been that we might use them first. Both Chinese Communist Party doctrine and current Russian military doctrine is that we're never going to use them first. But if you use them at all, then we're going all out and we're going to nuke you.
Yes, but how much does the Pentagon really care about its US cities and its own citizens?
Well, they've war gamed things where they're going to have we kill millions of them and somehow somebody's won. They still do that. Absolutely bonkers as it is. And of course, nobody's going to win. It's pretty clear. I mean, the latest missiles, not super duper missiles, as Trump refers to what they're going to do. They're called hypersonic missiles, and they can hit anything on planet Earth within 25 minutes. So they can wipe out, basically, for example, an attacking naval task force in the South China Sea. That's not even using nuclear weapons.
Also, there is another headline relating to China, which is COVID preps military for war with China and Russia. This is US military is using its new data collection system designed for war in the response to the pandemic. The Pentagon sees the new JADC2 system as vital for beating China and Russia in military confrontations. US Northern Command is using a new data collection system to track the spread of COVID-19. Joint All Domain Command and Control, JADC2, is a project in its infancy designed to collect information on all aspects of military operations using artificial intelligence. Data to be shared between all branches. The idea is to connect every piece of military hardware to the network. But another aim of JADC2 is to give commanders the ability to swap out weapons in the middle of a war, meaning commanders will be able to simultaneously control every tool on the battlefield, making it harder for enemies to prioritize defense. But this is being rolled out as a potential, well, it's being used now by the military as a way to respond to the pandemic, but actually sounds to me, Martin, like a little bit of software to turn the battlefield into some sort of wargaming platform where you can drag and drop bits and pieces around the battlefield.
Well, I mean, you can imagine that all the high level militaries are engaged in this kind of use of artificial intelligence to try and up their game. Underlying all of this is, I mean, the biological warfare aspects of this are fascinating, in the sense that the Chinese had attacks on their pig herd and their chicken flock, and then this pandemic comes along. They're beginning to wonder if they're basically being targeted by this. Incidentally, it's quite clear that Porton Down and all the other biological warfare facilities in the West were not looking into how to protect against biological warfare. Otherwise, we'd have had a completely different response to the pandemic than the one we've had. In Bulgaria, they've had quite a good COVID war, but that's because they just dusted down the old Warsaw Pact. We're under attack biologically. What do we do? I think that the West's biological warfare program is fundamentally offensive and not defensive. That's pretty clear. And the rest of the world is getting pretty fed up with the arrogant and bloodthirsty attitude of the ruling oligarchy in the West.
Okay, so anyway, let's move on to look at the whole case of Julian Assange now. It's been kicked into the long grass until the autumn, as I understand, Martin. So it, again, a little bit like Meng Wanzhou, you know, you've got a case for extradition where the person is left in limbo. It's almost like you're arrested at the airport and you're stuck in a room for 18 months while they decide what to do with you. This is where Julian Assange is. And many have compared the whole house arrest of Julian Assange to the this whole idea of the lockdown, where particularly vulnerable people have had to spend weeks and weeks and weeks in their homes, obviously for different reasons, but it's a similar experience for them. But anyway, I thought we'd have a listen now to Andrew Feinstein. He's a former ANC MP in South Africa, who's also the author of The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade. And here is his take on some of the comparisons between the Assange case and what his experience was of apartheid South Africa.
Just listening to the other speakers so far, in particular to Craig's description of the court process, quite honestly reminds me of the farcical legal processes that we used to endure under apartheid, where you had this impression sitting in a court of law that this was all theater that was being enacted to try and give the impression of due legal process, where it has already been decided that there shall be no due legal process. And it really concerns me that this is happening in the United Kingdom of today. But I suppose taking the sort of context that Chris Williamson has outlined, we shouldn't be surprised. And why do I say that? Well, I know most of you who are on this call will realize this, but perhaps to some of you coming to this issue more recently, let us just reiterate what Julian Assange is being persecuted for. He's being persecuted for revealing the crimes of the US government and its allies, primarily the US's biggest poodle when it comes to military matters, the United Kingdom. He is being prosecuted for speaking truth to power. And if we are not able to stop this corrupt and illegal process that is currently carrying on, we would not just have failed an individual in Julian. We would have failed the task of truth-telling, the task of journalism, the task of holding power to account. We will also have abandoned the right of every citizen to know what our government is doing in our name and with our money. We should also bear in mind that what Julian has done is he has violated the sanctified code of the national security state. And what do I mean by that? Everything that happens in the domain of national security is hidden behind a veil of national security imposed secrecy. So we look at the specific crimes that Julian and WikiLeaks have revealed, but we remind ourselves that every day similar crimes are happening using primarily American and British weapons to murder innocent civilians in Yemen. As Chris Hedges, the former New York Times war correspondent who was fired for publicly opposing the invasion of Iraq, has said, if citizens were actually shown the true images of the conflicts that we are engaged in, the conflicts that we are providing the weapons and the financing for, if we could see those real images, if we could read the real reports of what was happening in those wars, we as citizens would not allow this to happen in our name. So what Julian and WikiLeaks have done is to bypass that sanctity of national security imposed secrecy and to reveal to us citizens what is really being done in our name. And I should just mention, based on my research over the past 20 years, that it is not just the murder and mayhem of war making that is being hidden from us here. It is worth bearing in mind that the global trade in weapons accounts for 40% of all corruption in all world trade. And who benefits from that corruption? Corruption that, for instance, saw the United Kingdom pay members of the Saudi royal family, the son of Margaret Thatcher, Mark Thatcher, and numerous intermediaries, £6 billion in bribes. Who benefits from these bribes? It is politicians, corporate executives, and intermediaries such as arms dealers, banks, auditors, consultants, and lawyers. They make fortunes out of the arms trade and out of our war making. And it is this bribery and corruption that oils the wheels of our corrupted political processes. When one considers the nature of the power of the national security state, one can feel extremely daunted. When one hears the accounts of what is happening in court when Julian appears, one can feel incredibly depressed and powerless. It's a feeling that many people in South Africa grew up with during the worst years of apartheid. And some of us think that as we got towards 1994, when apartheid finally came to an end, that the 10 years previously were probably a time in which we saw a loosening of this, what was effectively an authoritarian, reactionary, racist oligarchy. But in fact, it was the years leading up to the end of apartheid that were amongst the worst to endure for the majority of South Africans. Because as the apartheid state claimed that it was starting a process of reform, in the African townships of the country, it imposed even worse repression than had been seen historically. But it never resulted in people on the ground in South Africa and in the international anti-apartheid movement losing hope. At a slightly anecdotal and personal level, I was forced to leave South Africa in the mid-1980s because I'd become involved with the then banned ANC from my late teens, and I was due to be called up for service in the apartheid military. I was taken out of the country, very fortunately. And the night before I was leaving the country at very short notice, I remember sitting above the city of Cape Town, my hometown, and what I, in a probably prejudiced way, regard as one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And I remember thinking to myself that I will never again in my lifetime see this city. Because if anybody had told me in 1986 that 4 years later, the ANC would be unbanned, Nelson Mandela would be released from prison, and 4 years after that, Mandela would actually be elected as a democratically elected president of South Africa, I would have seriously questioned their mental health at the time. But the reality is that that is what happened. And it happened as a consequence of an extraordinary international anti-apartheid campaign and the vast majority of South Africans making their own country ungovernable for the authoritarian regime that tried to rule over them. And it's at times like these, when things feel as bleak as they do today in global politics, in the case of Julian Assange, in the really pathetic role that our mainstream media is playing in propping up the status quo, that we should remember these experiences of hope, these experiences of triumph. For if we allow the national security state to continue to do as it pleases, we, all of humanity, will enable the political and economic elite to destroy our planet, to make us far less safe, and to make our world far less democratic. So for all of us who've joined this call, there are crucial things that we can do. We can spread information to as many people as we can about what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have actually done, which has been a remarkable service to humanity. We can spread information about the nature of the court case and about why Britain is kowtowing to the needs of America in this particular case. Because that is the most powerful thing we have, is the power of information. And it is up to all of us who've been a part of this call to spread that information as widely as we possibly can, so that we can ultimately free Julian Assange, free the truth, and free ourselves from the national security state. Thank you very much.
So that's a former ANC member of parliament and anti-apartheid activist, Andrew Feinstein there. He's also the author of The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, bit of a friend of this program. We've been on several times over the years, Martin, but he's making these very important points about fighting apartheid and authoritarianism. What do you think the connection is between the South African apartheid and what's been going on with Julian Assange? And you might possibly wish to bring in the racism of the Israeli state.
Well, Assange obviously is being, it's a key case. I can't see that there's any case in English common law for him to answer. And the fact that he's being held in solitary confinement as if he was an international terrorist in Belmarsh prison is an absolute stain on the reputation of this country.
He may have been taken out of Belmarsh now, actually.
Well, at the same time, he shouldn't be in prison at all. And if you remember all the years that he was hiding out in the Ecuadorian embassy, the usual suspects, the Daily Mail, etc., were saying he didn't have anything to fear. He should just come out and have to face these allegations of rape from Sweden, which were never actually turned into a proper extradition request and were ultimately dismissed. And then when he didn't come out, they went in and got him, and he's being tried in a British court under the US Espionage Act, which isn't British law, it's US law. And it was created in the US initially to smash the opposition to the First World War. And it's had a very, very controversial history. It led to the imprisonment of Eugene Debs, who is the leader of the Socialist Party in the US in 1917. And Bill Hayward, who was the leader of the Industrial Workers of the World, fled to Russia to avoid being imprisoned under the Espionage Act. It's essentially an undemocratic act of repression, and it's not very, it's very rarely used, but it's being used against Julian Assange in a British court. What's that? And of course, he's not either a British citizen or a US citizen. And of course, what the US are now trying to do is make their courts superior to other people's courts around the world. So in the run-up to this attempted coup in Venezuela, the courts in New York decided that Maduro was a narco-terrorist, and they issued a warrant for his arrest, which was then, of course, the basis for this completely illegal armed intervention. In Argentina, the government did a deal with its creditors to settle. You know, some money would be paid, but most of it would be written off. Peter Singer, big supporter of the Republican Party, he bought up loads of Argentinian debt for pennies. He then took it all. He then took a court case out in New York, saying that the debt said you owe me millions. And the court said, oh, yes, you are owed millions. And then the Argentinians were told that all the deals they'd done to reduce their debts were all over. They've got to pay all of it 100% because a court in New York has decided that they owed the money. And of course, they're going to do the same sort of thing with the Chinese. They're going to say, oh, well, you started COVID-19. So all the money that we say you say we owe you, because, of course, the Chinese are owed loads and loads of dollars. We're not going to pay you. And we're also going to potentially impound your merchant ships because the Chinese have got a massive merchant navy. All of which is totally unacceptable. It's not legal. It's about as legal as Hitler's invasion of Poland.
The Belmarsh Supermax prison where Assange has been held, he's still there apparently, is regarded as UK's version of the American facility at Guantanamo Bay. Beside Assange, the jail is home to mafia henchmen, Al-Qaeda members and neo-fascist enforcers. But was anyway, like Tommy Robinson. 20% of prisoners in Belmarsh are murderers and 2/3 have committed violent crimes. So it's even possible something might happen to him while he's in there, Martin, with all these people.
Well, interestingly enough, he was allowed out of solitary confinement eventually because the other prisoners, including the murderers, etc., said that's uncruel and unusual. And they were approaching the governor and saying, let him out and come and let him socialise with us. It's not fair. You're keeping him in solitary confinement. And that's when his solitary confinement was finally released. But let's get to the bottom of this. He shouldn't be there. It's as simple as that. This is an absolute outrage to British justice.
And he's confined in a glass cage.
Well, in other words, they're not even allowing the public to see how these court case is being conducted. The magistrate in charge, her husband's got links to the military industrial complex and the Tory party, all of which should basically have the liberal opinion in this country up in arms. But of course, it doesn't, because in actual fact, they're all bought and paid for. The Guardian is not doing leader articles on why this is outrageous. It's not becoming the Dreyfus affair, which it should be.
Yes, but that is peculiar, Martin. Maybe we can dwell on that for a second, because Julian Assange and WikiLeaks were feeding massive exclusives to the Guardian newspaper for years.
Yes, and they used them. And then what happened was various people who were involved with that then decided to ditch Assange. And as you probably aware, many of our listeners will be aware, the Guardian is, in fact, certainly the foreign affairs section is basically run by MI6, which is why they have all this tear-jerking stuff about the white helmets rescuing babies in Syria, even though in actual fact, they're the ones who are working with Al-Qaeda to kill babies at our expense. And of course, Julian Assange exposed all of this sort of stuff, and that's why he's in prison, and they're where they are, making money out of it all.
Also this week, FBI search warrants have revealed that Trump's aides, messages to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The FBI search warrants reveal that Trump campaigner Roger Stone sent private messages to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange after the site published thousands of documents that damaged Hillary Clinton's election campaign. This is by Bill Goodwin in Computer Weekly. And this was from a couple of weeks ago. He's a strategist and associate of U.S. President Donald Trump. And he was exchanging private messages with Assange. So obviously the guy is known to Donald Trump, although he seems to be shrugging his shoulders now. I've never heard of WikiLeaks.
Well, that's right. I mean, what that's about is about the so-called hacking of the Democratic National Committee computers. Now, what that showed is that the primary setup in the Democratic Party was basically being rigged, and nobody disputes that it was rigged. But the Democratic establishment then said, but that just makes us look bad, and therefore it must be the Russians that hacked in to make us look bad, although completely skating over the fact that the emails make you look bad because you're bad. You rigged it. It wasn't the Russians who were rigging the primary process.
Look, Martin, one place where Julian Assange still is making headlines is guess where?
Well, Australia, I would hope.
You're absolutely right. And in Australia, the headlines literally 2 days ago, UK is endangering Assange's life by imprisoning him. Says his partner. So, I mean, this is it possible he's going to end up like Slobodan Milosevic at the International Criminal Court, who died whilst he was being so-called put on trial?
Well, he's clearly been persecuted, you know, in a very, very severe way, and his health isn't good. And so if he did die, it wouldn't be a surprise, would it? And then, of course, that's problem solved from the point of view of the establishment are doing this to intimidate others. That's why they're doing it. It's not just about
him. Well, wasn't it Joseph Stalin that you've quoted this to me before? It says, no person, no problem.
Yes, it is Stalin who said that. And he also said, the only unity of opinion is in the graveyard. I mean, he didn't quite mean it like that. He was trying to, at the time, pretend to be a liberal. But, of course, he certainly went to town on that as a philosophy.
Okay,
but the point about Julian Assange, this should be, it shouldn't even be a political issue. Everybody, somebody like David Davis, who claims to be in favour of human rights, this is wrong. And if we don't draw the line here, you are basically opening the door to totalitarianism.
And there is a ray of hope from what Andrew Feinstein was saying, that he would think that if anyone thought that there was going to be black majority rule in South Africa, he would think of them as a mad person. But actually, it does get to a point where things can really change, can't they?
It does. But there's a difference between hope and expectation. The situation has got worse and worse since 9/11, since the collapse of the banks in 2008. You know, since the invasion of Iraq, since the collapse of Syria under Western and jihadi assault, you know, anybody who thinks there's going to be a business as usual once we get out of the pandemic is deluded.
It's business as usual within the pandemic, because this week India and China have been moving more troops into the border region, according to Bloomberg.com. Trump has tweeted an offer to mediate between the two nations. I'm not sure if either of them are going to take that one up. And China's move matches its actions in the South China Sea, so Bloomberg says anyway. India has moved additional troops along its northern border as it prepares for an extended conflict with its neighbour. China, after several rounds of talks, failed to ease tensions. China's already placed 5,000 extra soldiers and armoured vehicles within its side of the disputed border in the Ladakh region.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the explanation for that, to my mind, is that the Americans are going for a maximum pressure strategy on China. So Modi, who is himself effectively a neo-fascist murderer, is being encouraged to pick a fight with the Chinese just to keep them, you know, they're basically, you know, the people in Hong Kong are being encouraged to protest. Uyghurs in the northwest province of China are being encouraged to rise up. The Indians are being encouraged to put pressure on China from that direction. Trump is threatening to sue them for COVID. The trade deal is off. You know, at a certain point, if you push people to their backs to the wall, they may lash out. And of course, what a Chinese general this week was saying, well, we're not necessarily going to reunite Taiwan without fighting. If necessary, we will invade Taiwan. So they feel that they've got to make threats back, because threats are being made to them. And it's a pretty dangerous situation.
OK, well, anyway, let's go on now to look at this so-called mark of the beast. This is called the COVID pass. The idea is, genius idea, that you get a little digital ID certificate, either as some kind of on some sort of microchip on a card that you carry around with you, a sort of ID card that you carry everywhere, which will allow you to go into pubs and things like this and not to have to do any of this social distancing, which is so irritating for many people. And maybe, for example, to not have to wear a mask, that kind of thing. The virus apparently is on the way out. So why is this being introduced, some might ask? The passport linked to health status is discriminatory and should be illegal, some are saying. But anyway, the biometric update is the website where I found this, Martin. The question, of course, has got to be, who is funding this? And it's actually a website all about the COVID pass, and it's being funded by a chap called Sir Ronald Cohen. He turns out to be a staunch Blairite and funder of the Labour Party. So he is, it seems, very political. But anyway, Martin, before we talk about him, what do you make of this whole idea of having a digital ID in order to get back to normal? And if you don't have it, you're going to have to social distance indefinitely.
Well, I think this all the first point to make is all based on the idea that there will be a vaccine, and it's quite possible that there won't be. So in which case, why bother to develop all these techniques for working out who's been vaccinated for a vaccine that doesn't exist? What might be possible is if you've got tested people and you've tested that they're COVID free or they've got antibodies, then they should be able to socialize. And of course, you've then got to find some mechanism for identifying who those people are. But of course, there's a desire to control the population anyway, whether digitally or otherwise. And that is the, and also there's a desire to make money out of selling vaccines.
I mean, surely you don't want to control your population too much, otherwise they'll think they're living in a police state and they won't want to fight any wars for you.
Well, I think the we're already under virtually 24-hour surveillance anyway. So, you know, there's people kind of freaking out about the fact that they might be chipped. They're largely missing the point. You're already under surveillance. Everything we do these days means you're trackable by electronic means, and we know because Snowden told us that they've been collecting. It's not legal, it's illegal, but they've been doing it. It's even in the US Constitution.
Let's have a look at the guy that's funding the COVID chip. He's called Sir Ronald Cohen. He's a very political figure as well as being an investment fund manager. In 1974. He stood as the parliamentary candidate for the Liberal Party in Kensington North. In 1979, he stood as its European candidate in London West. So he's been in the EU elections and the UK parliamentary elections as a Liberal candidate. But in 1996, he switched allegiance to the Labour Party just before Tony Blair and I suppose just after Mo Mollem and her prawn cocktail offensive got the City of London behind the Labour Party. He jumped on board, becoming a supporter of Tony Blair. In 2004, he was the Labour Party's fourth largest financial supporter after Lord Sainsbury, Sir Christopher Gnatty and Lord Hamlin. So he's up there with the big boys, Martin, the Blairites supporting the Labour Party, who joined up with the Labour Party after the prawn cocktail offensive. I mean, can you tell us a bit about who you know, what people like him and who they are?
Well, the prawn cocktail offensive wasn't Mo Mollem, it was John Smith. But the general gist of what you're saying is true. I mean, at one stage, Blair's stated policy was to get the Labour Party funded by big business figures so that he was liberated from having to negotiate with the trade unions. Because up to that point, the trade unions had been the main source of funds for the Labour Party. And, of course, that meant they had quite a big say in what the policy was.
He's got a point there, hasn't he? Surely these big financiers are easier to chat to than the unions.
Well, they are. And, of course, the kind of things they're asking for are more amenable to what Tony Blair wanted to do. So that's why he was manoeuvring in that direction. Ultimately, follow the money in politics. That explains quite a lot. I mean, in Norway, for example, political parties are funded on the basis by the state on the basis of what their last showing in the last election was.
Anyway, look, Sir Ronald
that's
Cohen.
Not the case here.
Sir Ronald Cohen talks about himself, Kobe Pass Man, I call him. Sir Ronald Cohen. He talks about himself as an ethical investor. So let's have a listen to him and see, Martin, when he finishes, let's hear your reaction to whether you think he is or not.
The first social investment bank in the UK, which I was privileged to co-found with Nick O'Donoghue, funded by bank account money that had been separated from its owners for 15 years or more. And just stayed on the balance sheets of the banks. That money was released, and with $1 billion worth of money, we created the social investment bank and began to bring investment to not-for-profits. And then the G8 experience, where Matt was a very loyal partner and active partner, where we began to create boards in each of the leading industrialized countries of the world and get feedback on what was going on with social issues in these countries. And it was then that the light bulb, a second light bulb, came on after the social impact bond light bulb. And that light bulb was, you know what? Values are changing. Young people want more meaning than just making money. They want to be able to impact favorably the lives of other people. Young people connect with others in far away countries. They identify with them. And perhaps they understand that they're going to inherit a very problematic planet if nothing is done now.
So that is Sir Ronald Cohen, the man behind the COVID pass, the ID 2020 proposal, which is being looked at all around the world at the moment. And he's put a lot of money into developing that, marketing it, Martin, and actually saying to governments, well, you get my COVID pass and it's going to help you get out of this rather sticky situation, help your population get back to work.
Well, as I said, I think we've said what we need to say about the COVID pass. There isn't a vaccine yet, so there's not much point having a pass unless you've got a vaccine. I think on the general points he's making there, it's what you might call caring capitalism, which was very much the sort of thing that Blair thought he was into. I mean, I used to be social economy officer, development officer at Bristol City Council, and there's nothing wrong with building up a third sector of enterprises which are not for profit and have non-traditional goals like, you know, inclusion or sustainability or whatever. The problem is it's over-egged.
Bristol Energy was one of these
Exactly. So in other words, they may end up making no money at all, in which case, what's the point of them? Or they end up not actually tackling the problems they really need to tackle. So, for example, what we really need to do is we shouldn't have privatized the energy industry. And then we would be able to have the government be able to decide what strategy it wanted to pursue in relation to all sorts of things, climate change, inclusion.
Renationalize it,
Well, I mean, renationalize it. What they did in Venezuela with these things is what you do is you regulate the existing utilities to the point where they can't make money and their share price has basically gone down to zero. And then you buy it off them for nothing.
That sounds like a brilliant plan. Okay. Anyway, let's have a listen now to some clips about the from the documentary The Truth About Vaccines. And we start, first of all, this is a US documentary with one where they look at the potential. And this is a very recent one, so it's been made after the beginning of the lockdown, about you possibly having your kids taken away.
Check out this shocking video clip from Dr. Michael Ryan from the World Health Organization, who leads the team responsible for treating COVID-19.
In most parts of the world, due to lockdown, most of the transmission that's actually happening in many countries now is happening in the household, at family level. In some senses, transmission has been taken off the streets and pushed back into family units. Now we need to go and look in families to find those people who may be sick and remove them and isolate them in a safe and dignified manner.
Just so you know, we're coming to your house, seizing your children, removing them from the house by force, and isolating them in a safe and dignified manner. I don't think so, Dr. Ryan. That may work in the UK, but you try that in the USA, and you're going to find out that the majority of us still believe wholeheartedly in all the amendments listed in the Bill of Rights.
Sadly, the United States Constitution really doesn't seem to matter anymore. According to Dr. Ron Paul, what is most dangerous throughout this coronavirus pandemic is that although this virus will eventually disappear, the assault on our civil liberties is not likely to be reversed.
So that's a clip there from The Truth About Vaccines. A bit scary, Martin, isn't it? The idea of people coming in and saying, oh, you've got a sick child, we're going to take them away now. Because the children generally tend to get very, very mild symptoms.
Well, I mean, if you look at the contact and trace regime in South Korea, I won't bring in China because basically they treat it as a biological warfare attack. They basically didn't have a full on lockdown, but that's because everybody who they thought had got it, they checked everybody that they'd spoken to. So, for example, they were able to identify the individual that went to various gay bars in Seoul and infected loads of people, you know, presumably by, you know, getting up close and friendly with them. And they traced all of those people, and they were then all.
I mean, it might be they're saying there, aren't they, that it might happen in Britain, but it's likely to meet with rather more resistance in the US. Anyway,
well, as we said earlier, there could easily be a civil war in the US.
So anyway, the next clip from it is about some fake news footage which was spotted by these American documentary makers on Channel 4.
We'll address the coronavirus vaccine more in a moment. But first, we wanted to address some of the potential misinformation about COVID-19 coronavirus, which has drastically affected the way we live our daily lives here in the United States and across the globe.
Much of the USA and the world is in lockdown, self-quarantine. And previously jam-packed places like Grand Central Station, which used to see millions of visitors a day, and airports, which were previously bustling, are now virtually empty, with thousands of flights being canceled every day. Basically, coronavirus has created a bunch of ghost towns.
We already showed you in episode 8 how the mainstream media tends to be all in the same script. So, is it possible that they are all on the same script with COVID-19?
For example, toward the end of March, when New York City became the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak, in the United States at least, Governor Cuomo was calling for more ventilators and more hospital beds, since he said it had become a war zone in New York City. On multiple channels, we were shown this footage, which appeared to be of a semi-busy ICU at New York City in a hospital.
However, we soon discovered that it wasn't actually New York City. That was footage previously shown by Sky News of Italy on March 22nd, 3 days before.
Check it out. You can see the CBS broadcast of March 25th on the top and the Sky News broadcast of March 22nd on the bottom. Same footage. And by ICU standards, not really all that busy.
Yeah, so that's a little clip from the documentary. But I also think it's be quite useful to listen, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, to Dr. Andrew Wakefield. And he's concerned about some of the ideas that are circulating about mandatory vaccines. And he starts really by talking about what did we actually learn anything from Nazi Germany? I mean, let's hear what you think, whether he's exaggerating. And this is the so-called discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield, but at least he's a medical doctor, which Bill Gates is not.
Now they've taken that right away from the children's doctor, the person who knows these children, and put it in the hands of a state official who's never met them, doesn't know them, and frankly doesn't care. So there is a dramatic limitation of medical exemptions in order to exert control over vaccination policy. It's catastrophic. Firstly, there is no place whatsoever in medicine for any mandated procedure. None. Zero. And Nazi Germany taught us that. Experimental medical programs in people who did not have informed consent is abhorrent, is totally unacceptable to the conduct of ethical medicine. You can't do it. You must never do it. But that's what's happening here in California. People are being forced into a medical procedure with known risks, with quantifiable risks, where they have to pick up the consequences of a permanently damaged child. No one cares. There's nothing there for them, no infrastructure in place to protect that family. They bear all the liability. So when that child, that parent, hands their baby over to the doctor to be vaccinated, then the least informed person in that relationship, because you can't sue the doctor, you can't sue the pharmaceutical companies, the least informed person bears all the liability and all the risk, the mother. And that's atrocious. And so there is no place whatsoever for mandated medical procedures in any civilized country in the world. And that is what is happening here and what they intend for the world. And it's got to stop.
So that's Dr. Andrew Wakefield, the discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield. We've got a minute or so to discuss that, Martin. What do you make of his linking this to Nazi claims of experimentation on human beings in Nazi Germany, saying actually nobody should be mandated, it all should be done under informed consent?
Well, I'm generally of the opinion that things should be done under informed consent. You know, bringing Hitler into any argument is you know, an emotive way to argue. I think there's lots of cases to answer about the vaccination industry and all the rest of it. It clearly is a racket. And I think that, you know, RFK Jr.'s investigations of it have demonstrated that it is. And what we need to have is a genuinely public healthcare system, including publicly owned pharmaceutical companies. And that's what they want in the developing world as well. They want to be able to produce basic vaccines and basic goods without having to pay patents to the big pharma industry. But to say that things should always be dealt with by informed consent. I think that's in general that's correct.
Yeah, but the thing is, it should be the patient's choice rather than. But I mean, of course, they may actually just simply use coercion, make people's lives as difficult as possible.
Well, yeah, but
also,
there is a case. I mean, the best way to do it is, of course, to persuade people that it's in their interests and that the people who are asking you to do this are doing it because they've got your interests at heart. But of course, that's very hard to do when, you know, we've got an oligarchic run system, which is basically run. I mean, it's quite clear that the pharmaceutical companies are not looking to cure things. They're looking to create situations of ongoing illness, which allow them to carry on making money.
So anyway, that documentary is part 9 of the, they call it a documentary series. It's called The Truth About Vaccines. And I'll put up a link to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And I look forward to the live TV debate streamed and watched on television around the world between Dr. Andrew Wakefield and plain old Bill Gates. So anyway, thanks to our guest in the first hour, former Communities Minister, Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. You can hear Danny Lopsch on Sunday evening at 7. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be on BCFM every Monday, but it hasn't appeared so far. You'll certainly find this and Dialect online at thisweek.org.uk. We'll be back on FM soon. Pat Hart willing. Do please join us for our politics show live stream at the old time of 5 o'clock. Until 7 next Friday, God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.